at the phone and is now in the possession of the armor.
Come through as soon as you want to act that could be.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them and they stayed the exact same spot the whole time. They're out far, like I say that.
Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Mark, what is it? Are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit. UFOs over New York,
and I ain't too surprised. Well, the thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I saw it.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange day indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and thanks for downloading this podcast, which is edition 434 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This week, the first in April 2007, editorial contributor Dave Verlott, abductee and former assistant to the late Professor Dr. John Mack, head of psychiatry at Harvard University, Will Boucher, and the Dean of Ufology, publisher of the Journal of UFO History, author and researcher Richard Hall. But first up, a couple of years ago, Gary, a listener, sent me a home audio recording of his grandmother, who had a series of strange sightings on a lake near Bob Cajun here in Ontario, Canada. The original was real noisy, but in the ensuing years, software has become available that cleans up audio noise. So it sounds a little whooshy, but here is Gary's grandmother with her report.
This was reported to you by my grandmother, who is just approaching 95 years of age. Not a person to exaggerate. What she tells you here is what she and five other people witnessed.
This was in November, around 83 or 84. I just can't remember the year. It was our bingo night. 6:30, we leave. My neighbors, next door neighbors, went to the bingos with it, and they came out. I walked out on the deck, waiting for my husband to lock the side door, and thought what a beautiful night. It was so still, not a sound, dark, peaceful. And my neighbors came out at that time. I don't know whether their deck lights were on or not. And I looked towards the lake, and here is what I thought was a fancy yacht parked 30 feet from the house. Was there, nobody ever heard it come in. Not one sound. And we'd never had anything big come in the bay before. Just rowboat or motorboats like ours, which only 15, 16 feet boats, that sort of thing. Because the water isn't that deep. And there was lights across the top of it. That's all I could see at that point, was these lights. And I tried to look through them to see if somebody was looking at me, but you could see a light, but you couldn't see any forms or anything. It's like a glass brick, 4 or 5 inches square, and there was about 10 or 12 of them across the top of this boat. The lights were colored orange, blue, all the way across. The nose of the boat wasn't sharp. It was rounded, sort of. I couldn't see the other side of it, of course. I just saw the side that was up against our wall, where you would just step out the door of the boat onto the lawn. But there was no doors or regular windows or anything, nothing. I looked quickly around the lawn to see if I could see any people that might have got off the boat, maybe visiting neighbors in the area, and there was nobody there. And I knew whoever was in that boat was watching us. All I had to do was walk down the steps from the deck, which we did. We were getting within about 6 feet of it, I swear. I looked up at it, and it was metal, made of metal. There was no windows, no doors, no rails, nothing. But I said, "Carl," and instant I said, "Carl," it took off straight up in the air. All I heard was a very faint hum. There was no other sound. I was stunned. We were all stunned. And when I think back on it, the water wasn't disturbed at all, so it couldn't have been sitting in the water, which is only about 3 feet below the lawn. And all of a sudden, when it circled the bay overhead, there was swish, swish, swish. It seemed like small airplanes in the dark. They were just dark forms. In fact, when these things swished over our heads, the men were tall men. They ducked too. I ducked, I know. It was so close, but this swish, and that's just as fast as I could see it. That's how fast they traveled. Swish, swish, swish. And they went behind the island, which was about 1,000 feet away from our house. And the lights went out. There was no more. Period. We went to the bingo. And the people in the lineup waiting for cards were talking about these planes or whatever it was. And a couple of women had been coming down Curve Lake Road into the village to the bingo. And she said, "Oh, it was just a helicopter. It followed us all the way down Curve Lake Road." I said, "It was no helicopter. You'd hear it. It was a helicopter." That was the end of that. Next morning, my neighbor, Gwen, she was going out to see if she could see any signs in the bay, and I followed her out, and there was this big area around, I think, 15, 20 feet, maybe, where all the bulrushes, the tall grasses were down. I phoned the newspaper, and they said they'd had other calls in. They wanted to know if there was a power station near me. And I said, I didn't know. Anyway, they thanked me for calling. And that was the last I heard of it. It bothered me for a couple of weeks after that. I was depressed. When I went to Toronto to visit my daughter, I told them about it, and they said there was an address out in the west end of Toronto which you could write to report anything. So I did, and my son, he's a commercial artist, he drew a picture of it as I told him what it looked like and sent it in to these people. And they said they would get back to me. Never heard him. I was stunned. We were all stunned. I didn't think of UFOs or anything else. To me, it was a boat, and it still is a boat.
Well, I don't need you hanging around my door, trying to drag me down to the shore.
Indeed, on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlock.
There's an interesting little item in the UFO updates list this week, courtesy of the Secrecy News, that caught my attention. It seems that on the 13th of October, a press release was issued by the Director of National Intelligence and the Director of the CIA announcing the creation of a new agency within the CIA called the National Clandestine Service, or NACI, actually, for short. In announcing this new approach, Director Goss said, "The decision to create the NCS at CIA underscores CIA's proud position as the center of gravity for human in our intelligence community. No agency has greater skill and experience in this difficult, complex, and utterly vital discipline of intelligence." Goss added, "The announcement represents a grant of trust and an expression of confidence in CIA from the President, the DNI, and our partners throughout government." So let's see. The FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the IC, and now the NCS. E-I-E-I-O. It amazes me that any one country requires such a large quantity of intelligence-gathering agencies. But how does all this tie into UFOs, you might ask? Well, it's a well-documented fact that elements of the FBI, CIA, and although not yet completely proven, I'm sure the NSA, have conducted investigations into UFO sightings and reports and have compiled data about them. Now, through the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, several ufologists have managed to secure a number of CIA and FBI paperwork concerning what they know about UFOs. However, what is interesting with FOIA requests is that the information gleaned from them is not as important as the information that could not be obtained. It seems the CIA has a bad habit of losing files or pages from reports, and what might be an interesting piece of information suddenly becomes an incomplete document because of lost pages. They really should examine their hiring practices if their file clerks can lose important files so easily. And apparently, the CIA is not the only agency afflicted with losing important documents or parts of documents, because according to reports, the FBI has also released some files with missing pages. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but these agencies are the ones that gather, correlate, and compile bits and pieces of things to get an overall picture of what is going on in the world. That means they have to gather everything, no matter how small, in order to determine if some kind of threat exists or not regarding anything. So how is it that agencies with such delicate and all-encompassing responsibilities find it so easy to lose files and pages of files, aka data, when even the smallest shred of data could prove to be the ultimate link in a chain to be able to determine what is going on? Incidentally, HUMINT, it stands for human intelligence versus electronic intelligence. And according to intelligence gathering agencies, HUMINT is the most important and accurate gathering tool they have available. The latest announcement of the creation of a new intelligence agency within the CIA that will be integral to HUMINT means that supposedly residents of the USA will have superior intelligence gathering capabilities. Now, the only question is, will they be able to properly file and keep track of everything that they get their hands on? That's just my take on it.
Dave Berlant, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
FBI, CIA, FOIA, MOUSE.
You got it. E-I-E-I-O. Alphabet soup.
Yes, it's really astounding how much paperwork actually goes missing.
Oh,
it's not just the intelligence agencies. It's the non-intelligence agencies, like government departments, you know? Mm-hmm.
I mean, where are they hiring these file clerks from?
I don't know.
You know, is that a requirement of the job? You have to be able to lose pages?
Especially when files are taken out of secret stashes of documents,
mm-hmm.
there's a dozen places to sign for those. And when they're taken back, the receiver signs for every one of those pages in that folder.
Uh-huh. It's sort of like, oh, well, yeah, you take that out. Oh, don't worry about bringing it back.
Just throw it away. It's fine.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's cool.
We don't need that. We didn't need to gather that in the first place.
Exactly. It's scary is what it is.
It is. And I sure do believe they lose all those documents, too.
Of course they do. Mm-hmm. We know they do. They've got to lose those. I mean, what other reason could there be?
Well, look at all the documents from Roswell, the mm-hmm. Roswell Army Air Force Base.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, we lost a lot of documents. Right around that time, too, we were just buckets full of documents just disappeared.
Mm-hmm. All the stuff before and after. Oh, yeah, we've got that.
Oh, yeah. And you know, we know that the nurse didn't exist because she doesn't appear on the records that we have from exactly that time period.
Yeah, exactly.
Not that I really believe that there was a nurse around at that time anyway, but you understand what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes.
Allegedly a witness to the bodies that were recovered
exactly.
outside of Roswell, New Mexico, the nurse.
Yeah, the one who told the...
red-haired captain.
Undertaker.
And the Undertaker.
Red-haired
yeah.
captain
and the red-haired
is the
captain.
Other guy.
Yes.
He also doesn't exist according to the...
Well, how would they know
documents.
The documents from the Army Air Force Base there disappeared?
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any records, so how would they know whether he existed or not?
That's the interesting thing. It's not so much what we have to read out of these documents. It's what we're not allowed to read that's been lost or misplaced or what have you.
Yeah,
now we have to start wondering.
And thank you for that. It was excellent.
Cool.
Good night, Dave.
Good night.
There's a bug in my mind of an alien kind. All the right is all wrong and the wrong is all right. Gotta act, get him back, am I losing my track? The last will be first and the first will be last. I got a bug in my mind of an implant kind. Got a bug in my mind of an implant kind.
Bill Boucher has been an occasional contributor to the UFO Updates list, speaking on behalf a lot of the time of the John Mack Institute. And here... as it was then. Will Boucher was an assistant at the John Mack Institute. Will, after Dr. John Mack was tragically killed in London by a drunk driver, spent his remaining time at the John Mack Institute digitizing all of the archives that had been put together around John Mack. And he is now down in a little tiny city in New Mexico. It's amazing the number of people that are down there in Albuquerque in New Mexico. Joining us on the line from down there is Will Boucher.
I am indeed. I'm on the road. my eventual destination is hopefully Boulder, Colorado. But
Boulder, Colorado.
For a couple months, I'm holed up in this semi-desert city. Very nice place.
It is. It's a lovely place. My memory of it is a lot of stucco and a lot of nice sort of high desert colors there, pinks and oranges and yellows. And
it surely is. It's a good change from Cambridge. I loved my time there, but I never got used to the snow.
Yeah. It's amazing how small Albuquerque is, but that's where Wendy Connors lives and Richard Hoagland is down there. And a few others, too, live in that small city. It's good for you, I guess, to take a break from all of the apparent strangeness and a very different lifestyle that happened for you in Cambridge, huh?
Well, that's true. I mean, most of my friends who I met at the John Mack Institute, or the experiencers who worked with John, you know, many of them have retreated to private life. You know, they've moved on to other parts of the country. But even after John's death, you know, I remained working for his family, as you say, scanning in over 10,000 of his letters and essays and manuscripts in development. And that was a very good way to sort of do the grieving process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to move away from it, but something is drawing me back, and that something is Susan Clancy's latest book, Abducted, yeah. How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens.
I think that the majority of people who have an opinion on the book actually haven't read it, but I understand that you have a copy of it.
I actually got a copy of it about a week before it was published. I have to admit, I did not read it all the way through until this afternoon, and fortunately, it's under 200 pages. I read it while eating lunch, so... And I'd encourage everyone who's near a bookstore, who's interested in reading the book, go ahead, check it out.
Most people who would be inclined to read it, that listen to this program, would probably end up hurling it against the wall.
Exactly.
You were somehow peripherally involved with Susan Clancy while she was doing the research for this book?
Yeah, that's true. The origins of both Susan Clancy's research and, well, she was a doctoral student of another name you might recognize, Richard McNally, the two Harvard-trained people who really have a rather opposing view of alien encounters compared to John Mack. But I met them through the John Mack Institute. It was back in 99, in fact, where they were looking for experience or subject, and they were having a very difficult time finding any, and they contacted our organization. So John Mack said to me, "We'll try to get some of the experiencers I've worked with, see if any of them want to volunteer." And so I manned the phones, trying to round up a few, but it's very difficult because not many people really want to participate in these sorts of research. So finally I said, "Well, you know, they're having such a hard time finding anybody. I'm just up the street. I'm an experiencer myself. I'll help them out."
Mm.
So I actually met them, you know, several years ago. Fortunately, I was spared being in this book. I think I appear in like one or two sentences, which is fine with me.
Can we go back to the nature of your experience or experiences and then come back to Susan Clancy again?
Sure.
What got you?
Yeah, what got me? I mean, my experiences tend to be of the more surreal nature. I try to advocate the possibility that these alien encounters are more of an interdimensional type phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
At least they appear that way to me. I think that perhaps being in the suburbs rather decreased the chances of saucers landing in the backyard and so forth. But it didn't stop just the general appearance of beings in my environment. And so for years, I just had to consider the possibility that these were just some sort of illusions or dreams, since they tended to be at night. But over the course of many years, it just built and built to the point where it had such a structured narrative that I had to take it seriously. And that's pretty much when I got involved with John Mack's organization. I had intellectually come to the conclusion that it was a strong possibility that alien visitations were actually occurring.
Did these, in the same way that Susan Clancy talks about dream state abductions happening while the subjects are in bed,
sleep paralysis,
hypnagogic state, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were your experiences like that, or were they more like the John Velez, where, you know, within a few yards of his house, he sees this object overhead, and suddenly it's many hours later?
Yeah.
I mean, John is walking down the street or running terrified from this thing that he's seen in the sky above him.
Well, I sometimes envy those people who have that kind of confirmation. I think if I had that kind of hardcore experience, it would probably be very disturbing, because as emotionally close as you get to this experience, as much as you feel you've accepted it, every time something happens, it renews that sense of terror and just absolute amazement that something is actually occurring. No, my experiences have mostly just been with beings who have appeared in my room, sort of telepathic communication. I often am waking up from the experience, but it's not the sort of transitory state where you're in between waking and sleeping. You know, I become fully conscious. I've held these beings' hands. I've looked at their clothing. I've looked at their cheekbone of their face. Enough details, all recalled consciously. This isn't stuff that's been brought forth via hypnosis. I did at one point try Reiki, and during a Reiki session, I had a vivid sort of reliving of the emotional intensity of some earlier experiences. But even if I hadn't had that, my point of view is very similar to John Mack's in terms of the way these experiences affected me is what's most meaningful to me. It's not so much a question of, oh, what planet are they from? It's that they've completely redefined my concept of what reality is.
And I guess in a certain way have reshaped your brain in some way too, huh?
Well, this is exactly a part that Clancy actually gets right in her book. She has in the concluding chapter of her book, she discusses the spiritual impact. And her observations are really not that dissimilar from those of John Mack. She has this quote I'd like to read for you. She says, "During the experiment, something happened that I didn't anticipate. All of the subjects reported that the most traumatic experiences in their lives were abduction-related. That was no surprise. but some of them also reported that their most positive life experiences were abduction-related as well. All of the subjects, without exception, said they felt changed by their experiences. People went so far as to say, I'd be a much different person if I hadn't been abducted. I would have led a much emptier, drier existence. She concludes that being abducted by aliens is a transformative event. And that was completely the truth for me. You know, I was raised without any sort of sense of religious traditions, which typically teach that there's both a material level of the world and what theologians dub the spiritual part of the world.
Mm.
Now, when you have beings appearing, you know, from thin air, it's very suggestive of the kind of visits that in the old days one might have accounted as being visits from angels or from spirits or whatever can come from that so-called spiritual realm. But I think we're probably coming to a point where the so-called spiritual realm will eventually be redefined as other dimensions.
Mm.
You know, we may be decades away from that, but I think that's where we're headed. So Clancy's book actually gets it quite right in that she realizes that when people have these experiences, it sort of breaks open their worldview. It makes them redefine their concept of reality. It bonds them, in a sense, to the concept that other life is part of our extended family. But the difference between her and Mac is that Mac said, yeah, these are amazing insights that are all happening because these beings are provoking us towards this realization. Clancy, on the other hand, says that, no, these are all just the sort of pat stories a person tells themselves in order to find meaning in a meaningless world.
Hmm.
It's the kind of cynicism which is rife among skeptics, and it's sad to see a person like Clancy expressing it, but she has decided that she's only going to accept things that have hardcore scientific proof, and tragically that leaves out the entire range of alien encounter experiences which people are having.
And she restricted her field of view as far as abductees were concerned too, it seems. Has your thinking changed about life, the universe, and everything as a result of your experiences?
Absolutely. It sure has. Unfortunately, all the sort of revelation that I've gotten from my experiences, you know, ties into what Clancy would say is just a symptom of people's need to find meaning in the universe.
But you weren't looking for meaning in the universe.
No, sometimes it just kind of comes up and grabs you.
Yeah, well, yeah, bites you on the bum, as I recall.
But the sense of these aliens being sort of related to oneself, it's a fascinating area that I think is kind of misunderstood. Sometimes people hear that people think they're related to the aliens and they think that they mean biologically. And there may be some people who feel that, but the sense that I got from it was the concept that all sentient life, all life that has souls, is in a sense family. And I think although people can get that sort of feeling if, say, swim with dolphins or do other similar things, for me, it was the contact with these beings that really deepened that for me. This is also something that ties into research done not only by Clancy, but also by Richard McNally, and more recently by Christopher French, all three skeptics. In studying the personalities of experiencers, both here and in the UK, what they found is that experiencers have a greater degree of a personality quality called absorption. And absorption is essentially the ability to feel that one becomes one with an experience. That sort of connection is symptomatic of that personality trait. So what fascinates me about the personality studies of these people, despite the fact that these people are skeptics and saying these experiences aren't true, it's still there is the possibility that they may be correct, that the minds of experiencers may be a little bit different than average, a little bit more sensitive to forming that sort of connection to other life. And so I think when we criticize books by Clancy and McNally and French, we shouldn't throw out all their research because some of it might imply that there are particular qualities that people could develop to have better communication with these beings, or it may be that there's particular portions of the population that are more able to communicate with these beings, so perhaps that might reveal why aliens abduct some people and not others. You know, many different possibilities arise from their discovery of these personality traits, none of which are explored in her book, of course.
It seems to me that there are two types of people who've been through what they've been through. There's the experiencer type, like yourself, and to be honest with you, Will, you don't sound particularly traumatized by your experiences. And then on the other hand, we have the abductees represented by John Velez and a lot of the people who are in the documentary Touched.
sure.
By Laurel Chaitin, who were traumatized and have never been the same since. And there really has not been a lot of growth in their life. You know, the only thing that's grown in their lives is the terror of the threat and the confusion and the bewilderment.
First, I should apologize to anyone who feels that I may be dismissing the terror.
No, I don't think you are. What I wanted to do was for the people out there who are hearing this kind of discussion for the first time is to point out what it is that I see going on out there. And it seems that Susan Clancy, in her book, which is Abducted, How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens, has only dealt with the experiencer side of all of this and those who were taken from their beds during the course of their experience. And they haven't dealt with the abductees, the people who were driving home and were only a half an hour from home after a 5-hour drive, you know, suddenly came to in their car again after they'd seen this craft and a beam of light came down at them. It was 3 hours later and they were 150 miles back up the road that they'd come down, going in the opposite direction to their home. So the Susan Clancy's, the McNally's, and the French's haven't dealt with that side of this phenomenon.
It's true. Their sample is rather skewed because they were seeking volunteers. They were seeking people who apparently familiar enough with their experiences to be able to articulate their experiences to these people. So if the people that they spoke to as they were recruiting were still very traumatized by their experience and at a loss for words to even describe the horrors they had gone through, they probably didn't come across as stable and perhaps they were omitted. I have to say that Clancy seems to cover a pretty broad spectrum of experiencers in her book, people that she recruited through newspaper ads. And many of these people are very, very troubled by it. Thanks for saying I sound well-adjusted now, but you know, it was a several-year process for myself to reach this point.
Yeah, you sound very at peace with that whole experience now. I don't know what you were like a few years ago.
Yeah, it was terrifying at first. I mean, not being able to sleep with the lights off, of course, losing weight, feeling absolutely bewildered, searching for explanations. That is part of it. You know what really helped me, frankly, was being in an environment of the office of John Mack. Now, bear in mind, I was not one of his clients. I wasn't in therapy with John Mack. But simply being around people who credited these experiences as possibly real, that sort of sense of community does let one come to terms with their experience, and it helped me move beyond the fear. It helped me face the fear. It helped me see other people around me who had been through it and who had survived and who had turned out rather well.
And did you end up working for John Mack as a result of your experiences, or did your experiences come as a result of working for John Mack?
My experiences came first.
Ah.
I actually started out working for him, transcribing some of his clinical sessions. I'd been doing some temp work typing. That's how I was first introduced to their organization, was just typing up the clinical sessions that he recorded. And at some point, I was invited in to work at the office. It was all rather serendipitous for myself.
Yeah, isn't that a somewhat synchronistic that you go through what you go through and you end up working with one of the leading researchers on the subject?
It was fantastic. I disagreed with John Mack on a few points, but the general philosophy that he had was one that I shared. So it was a terrific growing experience for me.
Did you learn anything during the course of your experiences, Will Boucher? And not necessarily about yourself, but something external to you?
Well, there was a time when I tried to ask, sort of in meditation, for more information about these gray beings to try to get a sense of what their motivations were.
These were gray beings, huh?
That's typically what they're called.
Yes.
My own experience, they were a little bit more bone white, sometimes beige.
Mm-hmm.
Once one was very pink. Yeah, you know, the typical kind of beings.
Beings with a large almond-shaped eyes.
Yeah, and sometimes they have the heavier kind of, I call them babushka-type escorts, which are much bulkier and seem to do the heavy lifting. In a meditation, I tried to learn more about what their history was, what their reason was for being here, why they were interacting. And I got information which personally was satisfying to me, but I don't know what to do with it. Was it simply my imagination satisfying my curiosity? Was it their true history? Was it some sort of mythology which is symbolically real? You know, the difficulty with communicating with these beings is that, at least in my experience, they don't speak English. They're speaking in highly theatrical concepts. Even some of the interaction which they have with people seems to be more theater than for any practical purpose. I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that many men report having sperm extracted as part of the so-called hybrid project. At least they were up until around 99 or 2000. And yet, many people also describe having sort of intimate encounters of a sexual nature with an alien being, which wouldn't seem necessary if the process is purely mechanical and medical. The way I view these types of situations is the possibility that the beings are trying to communicate with us theatrically. They're trying to drive home the point that two species are coming together. They're coming together in a reproductive way and in an emotional type of bonding way. They're having to overcome a massive language barrier, and so they're doing so as best they can. Unfortunately, the high theater of it is also why people like Susan Clancy can view it all as metaphor, because, you know, of course, the best art works on many levels. So I don't think there's any sure way to convince skeptics that these experiences are real. It's up to people like us to credit the possibility that they're real and to try to learn as much as we can in our interactions with these beings. And when people are having terror in these experiences, I would hope that some of the guidance that they get might involve ways to ease the fear when an experience is actually taking place. For myself, when I learned meditation, I was able to slow my heart rate. So when an experience started up, I was able to be calm. I was able to remember the fact that I'm typically returned, apparently unharmed. And that changed everything for me. You know, I don't want to cause problems for this situation. I want to be in a situation of equality where I can communicate with the being and she or he can communicate with me. But until that point, the best I can do is just to be as calm, to try to listen, to try to remember as much as I can. And that's not easy. You know, that takes a lot of work. But I have to add that looking over the course of my life, the experiences I've had, I've seen very many efforts.